From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late this week, Pope John Paul II spoke out on the sexual abuse revelations that have recently scandalized the church and forced Catholics to confront what the pontiff called the mystery of evil. The Pope beseeched church members to reconcile the pain of human weakness with faith in divine grace.
For the Catholic press, reconciling such conflicts is an ever-present challenge. Most of the 180 member publications of the Catholic Press Association are published by a local diocese under the authority of a bishop. As such, in reaching their aggregate 6 million readers, these publications find themselves working for the very institution on which they report. When scandal erupts, that conflict is particularly confounding. Owen McGovern, executive director of the Catholic Press Association, says his members do their best to be good Catholics and good journalists at the same time.
Any sensitive issue that comes to light, you know, we report on it, and quite in depth. I mean, this week is the best example of it. The Boston Pilot, the Archdiocesan newspaper in Boston, just did a 28-page section on the situation involving pedophilia. And it's quite extensive, probably more extensive than you would find in the daily newspapers.
That's true. However, it was reporting that was triggered by a scandal that first broke not in the diocesan newspaper, but in the Boston Globe. Do Catholic newspapers do any of this investigative work themselves?
You very seldom see a weekly newspaper break any story, mainly because of the time element. We have small staffs. We don't go out doing investigative work. But if something like this came to our attention of any of these sensitive issues, first of all, our publishers of these newspapers happen to be bishops. And so first thing that would happen would be to find out what the reality is, what the truth is from the church's position. And we are Catholics, and our mission is education, communication, information, and evangelization. And that's basically the role the Catholic press plays. We don't go around breaking stories, but I would be less than honest if I said that if we did something like that, we would go to the church authorities and we would ask the questions with the intentions of writing the story. But on the same token, if the publisher, who is the bishop, took a different stance, then we would honor that stance as well.
Now, what you've just described is certainly a gross breach of journalistic ethics. Are you saying that because your publisher, in effect, is the bishop for a given diocese, that your responsibility is to keep him happy?
That's not the case at all. Like I said, we educate, we inform, we try to communicate as best we can. But we also have a loyalty to the church, and that can't be denied, and I'd be the last one to deny that. And our loyalty to the church is why we're in business. We're not in business to make a profit. We're not in business to sell newspapers to that extent, but we would like to offer our readers the truth, and we would hope that the church would feel the same way. And we don't do it in the name of journalism. We try to practice good journalism practices, but there is a fine line. We don't feel we're censored. There are cases, I'm sure, where bishops have more control over their paper than others, mainly because they want it.
There have been stories circulating and suspicions and conventional wisdom about sexual abuse by priests going back as far as I can remember. Hasn't your membership failed in its fundamental responsibility to its readers by not exploring these stories and trying to find out if they were true or not, and then holding their diocesan leaders' feet to the fire to see that they're acting responsibly with regard to the parishioners and the parishioners' children?
I would hope that none of the people that work in the Catholic Press Association as editors and journalists in general would know that this was going on and wouldn't not only report it to the church authorities, but report it to law enforcement as well.
Well then, going forward, what do you think is the role of, under these circumstances, in this new world we're living in, of your member newspapers? Should they be more aggressive? Should they take the church's assertions at face value, or should they dig deeper?
They have access to the whole story. They don't have to write half the story. So I think they should dig to get the whole story. And then I think the church right now, especially in its in what it's going through, I think the church will give that whole story where it didn't in the past. I think the newspaper will become more important than ever within the diocesan structure in order to make sure that they keep the people informed so that the people don't hear stories that may not be complete or may not even be completely accurate from other media.
Since the bishop is the publisher of most of the papers that are your members, can journalism really take place in that environment when the organization that you're reporting on is actually running the newspaper that you are working for? It's almost as if I were expecting the Enron company newsletter to break the Enron scandal. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, there is the fact that the bishop is the publisher. But again, to think that, you know, that this doesn't happen in the secular press, there are numerous instances where advertisers have been influential. I wish the secular news media were as pure as you would like them to be, and I would like them to be. As far as our concern, yeah, you know what? If the publisher says don't run the story's not going to run. If that's a problem for some, then that's a problem. But the reality is the final judge are the Catholic readers who want to hear from the bishop. They trust the bishop. They want to know what's going on in the church. And the Catholic newspaper is there to tell them.
Very well. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Owen McGovern is executive director of the Catholic Press Association. For all the inherent conflicts of reporting about the church for members of the church, it's interesting to note that the Boston Globe was by no means the first national newspaper to report widespread sexual abuse among Catholic clergy and the church's cover-up thereof. That distinction belongs to the National Catholic Reporter, an independent paper with no diocesan connection, published in Kansas City, Missouri. It was the Reporter that first revealed the pedophilia scandal more than 17 years ago and took a lot of heat for so doing. Among the accusations at the time, says current editor Tom Roberts, was that the paper was a journalistic Judas.
There were several different kinds of reactions. One was just what you said, that you're betraying the church and destroying it. The other is that you're making too much of a few bad apples, you know, a few isolated cases. Others just said, you know, that this simply should be taken care of quietly. That there's no business letting this news out. On our own board at the time, there was a reaction by one board member asking for a vote of no confidence in the editor at the time, Tom Fox, who is now the publisher. He didn't get a second. And he ultimately left the board. But there were real strains. It took, I think, a real act of courage to do that story and to keep after the story for so long.
A few months ago, before the Boston Globe broke its story, Bishop Joseph Galante of Dallas, who is head of the Communications Committee for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, said that he believes that the Catholic press should not be out muckraking, but should help unify the church. And he said that aggressive reporting violates principles of charity and respect for human beings and can often be too heavily weighted with innuendo. Do you think that attitude still resides anywhere in the church?
Oh, I think it does. And I think Bishop Galante in this case is simply incorrect. It's just silly to blame the messenger. John Courtney Murray, a famous Jesuit, gave a speech in the 60s to a group of Catholic journalists in Rome, in which he said that communities inside the church and out have an absolute right to information.
In my other life, I work for Advertising Age, which is a trade publication. It covers the advertising industry for the advertising industry, but it's not of the advertising industry, and sometimes it's difficult for the people we write about to understand that. They think we're somehow on their team. Are you on the team of the Catholic Church in America, or are you truly an independent voice? What is that relationship?
The analog to the general press is limited. I mean, there is a point at which we are, stakeholders in this enterprise called the church. We are of it. in a very real way, at least a lot of the people who work there. And again, that's part of the oddness of our niche. We are a specialty publication. We do cover the Catholic Church because of, you know, part of that grew out of concern for the institution and a real love for it.
You're Catholic. Has this challenged your faith?
It hasn't challenged my faith in the deepest aspects of the faith I profess. It has certainly shaken my faith in the institution. I think we're at some manner of threshold. I can't put a name on it, but I think that the leadership of the church, at least in the United States, is coming up against some very, very difficult truths.
One of the criticisms, but nonetheless one of the realities of day-to-day journalism, is there tends to be an us-against-them relationship between the press and the government. And I wondered if in reporting sensitive stories about the church, you find yourself regarding the church, of which you are a member, as the enemy. And how does that challenge you as a journalist, and how does it challenge you as a Catholic?
Yes, there are some instances where we are in an adversarial role. I never think of people or the institution even as my enemy. Part of the tragedy to the sex abuse story is that the church, which can exercise a really forceful role as a moral arbiter in the general culture, it can force the discussion on things, everything from, you know, the death penalty to abortion to nuclear weapons, and they're just draining themselves of credibility. You can't be a moral force in the culture and want to be a big player and get invited to testify, you know, before congressional committees and not expect to be scrutinized in your own activities. So, you know, we want to serve as both the watchdog for all of that activity and the bulletin board for all of that activity. And so that's where we place ourselves in the role. So I go to church every Sunday and rest easy. It doesn't rattle my faith to be in that role.
Tom Roberts, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Tom Roberts is the editor of the National Catholic Reporter.
Coming up, why the Saudi media are changing their tune and why Italian media only play one note.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And we're joined once again by the multi-talented and multilingual Martin Walker, senior correspondent for United Press International, to review the foreign press. This week, the subject is Saudi Arabia, reflecting some remarkable cultural shifts in its pages. Martin, glad to have you back.
Hello there.
An interesting occurrence in the Saudi press recently, a commentary about the ancient slander against the Jews, the blood libel, and then a retraction.
Yes, there's been a huge furor in the Arab press generally about this. On March the 10th, Al-Riyad, which is one of the main Saudi dailies, published an op-ed piece from an academic, a professor at King Faisal University, called Umaymah Al-Jalahma. What he said, quite simply, was that during the Jewish holiday of Purim in March, blood must be taken from a non-Jew, dried and mixed with dough to make the pastries. He goes on to say that using human blood to prepare these pastries was a well-established fact historically and legally throughout the history of mankind, and this was one of the main reasons for their persecution and exile in Europe and Asia at different times. Now, in fact, it is the age-old blood libel, one of the most horrendous libels against the Jewish people, and the instant reaction came from Michael Melchior, Israel's deputy foreign minister, who cited it as a classic example of the anti-Jewish hate and incitement in the Arab media. Normally it would end there, but this time the editor of Al-Riyad, Turki Abdallah Al-Suderi, wrote an editorial in which he condemned this piece. He said he was out of town when the article appeared. He hadn't known it was appearing. He'd only found out about it in a call from his newspaper's New York bureau chief, and he's instantly disavowed it.
It strikes me that the being out of town excuse probably dates back as far as the blood libel.
Well, and the check is in the mail. It's as old as that one as well. And he wrote that I found it unworthy of publication because it is not supported by any scientific or historical facts. The information in it doesn't go beyond the nonsense it's always carried by the yellow media, the yellow press. In other words, he's absolutely denouncing it and not simply trying to walk back halfway from this particular libel. And that's why it's had such a huge impact in Saudi Arabia, and it's coinciding with this other huge impact in Saudi Arabia, which is the dreadful case of the 15 schoolgirls who died in a fire because the rescuers were kept back by the religious police, who said it would be sinful for the rescuers to see the schoolgirls without their veils on. And this has been thoroughly denounced by the effective ruler of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Abdullah, denounced by several other leading members of the government. And it's the first time, really, that there's been a hint of a crackdown upon the Islamic fundamentalists, whether in the religious police or, in the case of the newspaper, with the Islamic fundamentalist academics who have been pursuing and promoting this extreme view of anti-Israeli Wahhabism.
Well, is there some sort of connection between the condemnation of the blood libel commentary and the condemnation of the actions of the religious police?
What we're seeing is this long fraud that the Saudi Arabian government has maintained of being broadly pro-Western in public, but intensely Islamic fundamentalist in private. That fraud is beginning to fray. It's beginning to become untenable.
Because you really can't separate what you say internationally and what you say locally anymore.
Well, that's right. In a sense, it's because of programs like this, where people who can read the Arab press and kind of say what is being said in the Arab world to Arabs, that's no longer private. We've now into an international media world where, in effect, what you say within your own national or family circle is pretty much spread and diffused everywhere. In a world of no secrets, it's kind of hard to maintain the two-faced policy that the Saudis have played with such success for so long.
And so when you have the Zinni-Cheney Middle East peacemaking trip, and obviously there would be reactions for Western consumption and reactions locally, how do those differ now?
Well, what I've been really struck by is that we've been seeing the classic Arab defensiveness from Al-Riyad. That's the same paper that printed the blood libel. Cheney came to the region to force the American view upon us and to attack Iraq. Arabs didn't like his views, and in return, he refused to meet with Arafat. This is undiplomatic, arrogant behavior, typical of the American worldview.
So as we consider the postures and the positions taken by the Saudi press in recent weeks, what we see, I guess, is an ability, a willingness to bend on a number of issues important to the United States, but not on Israel.
I think that's right. I think it's because for the Arab world and for the Saudis in particular, Israel is such an essential symbol. I mean, if it weren't for Israel, one really couldn't talk about any kind of unified Arab opinion. And you probably couldn't, if you were a Saudi leader, find it very easy to justify the nature of your regime unless you were able to cite, but we are solid on this whole issue of evil, which is why I find it so interesting that the only peace plan out there at the moment that seems to have any traction at all is the one pledging normalization with Israel.
And floated by Saudi Arabia.
Exactly, floated by Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia.
Once again, you've wrapped it all up for us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is the senior correspondent for UPI and author of the Washington Post bestseller, The Caves of Perigord.
In Italy, this weekend's massive demonstration against unpopular labor laws may be the first real challenge to Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Berlusconi is Italy's richest and most powerful man. His personal assets include 3 television networks, a major publishing company, an insurance and asset management firm, a slew of real estate holdings, and the AC Milan soccer club. When he swept into office in a landslide victory last May, he also took control of the 3 public TV networks. Now 95% of Italian television is in his hands. He's used his power over the media to charm citizens unsettled by years of fractured government, and chances are they will continue to hear only good news from the media mogul in chief. OTM's Megan Williams reports from Rome.
Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi loves to reminisce about his first job as a singer on a cruise ship. But where he once blew kisses in cocktail lounges, he's now serenading a whole nation. And it seems Italians are happily dancing to his tune. Berlusconi is Italy's richest man by a long shot. He came onto the media scene in the 70s and 80s, busting through legislation which for more than 50 years had given the Italian state a monopoly over television broadcasting. Berlusconi now owns the country's largest private television network, Mediaset. And last May, using a few of the millions in profit, and with the help of an inept opposition, he cruised into the job of prime minister. But despite a seemingly easy entree into the world of politics, one issue has dogged the Italian magnate from day one: conflict of interest.
Buonasera, pubblico porta a porta, e bentornato all'onorevole Silvio Berlusconi.
This is Berlusconi just before elections last year. As a guest on Italy's most popular talk show, he managed a stunning coup de théâtre. As if he already owned the place, Berlusconi installed himself behind the studio's cherrywood desk and with great flourish signed a list of election promises, which he called his contract with the Italian people. "If I don't keep my promises after I'm elected," he told the millions of viewers, "fire me." But even while he was making these promises, Berlusconi was using his multimedia expertise to publish a glossy magazine focused exclusively on himself, replete with snapshots of him with the stars and tales of his favorite pets. He also used Mediaset to help get coalition members elected to parliament by running wall-to-wall political ads. This helped in more ways than one. Since public TV in Italy isn't permitted to broadcast political ads, the opposition parties had to make a choice between lining Berlusconi's pockets and running no ads at all. They chose the latter. And then the voters made their decision. After years of ideological wrangling between communists and Christian Democrats, most Italians were all too happy to vote for someone who personified capitalist success and efficiency.
I think that for the economy, Mr. Berlusconi is probably the better choice for the economic experience and political vision he has.
The opposition keeps going on and on about this conflict of interests. They're just jealous that they're not as successful, that none of them could have accomplished what Berlusconi did. No one cares about the supposed conflict of interest. All this talk is just an excuse to try to get him out of office.
Berlusconi seems to have understood just how little most Italians care about the fact that he runs both the media and the country. Here's his response in an interview on public television about the issue just days before he became prime minister.
I don't think it's logical to announce just days before an election what I'll do with Mediaset when whatever I say will be manipulated by the opposition. Whatever I may announce will have to do with passing a conflict of interest law once I'm in government.
Nearly a year later, Berlusconi and his right-wing coalition, Forza Italia, seem at last to be taking steps to deliver the new legislation. Well, it hasn't passed yet. What the new law proposes to do is set up a watchdog authority that would alert the parliament if it found that the government was influencing media coverage. The authority, however, would be virtually powerless to effect change itself, unable to sanction bad behavior or block executive decisions.
Yes, this bill is not useful at all, at all.
Marco Taradas, a journalist with Radio Radicale, is a former MP with Berlusconi's Forza Italia. He says the fact that Italians found it acceptable to elect Berlusconi with the conflict of interest means the chances of him ever being regulated are slim.
It's impossible now. You can't control his power. And in the United States, we have a free press. We don't have a free press. You have a free and independent judiciary. We don't have. So it's not so easy.
Berlusconi's coalition has a secure majority in parliament. Opposition to the bill will be unlikely.
In Italy, we have the public television stations that are traditionally on the center-left wing, and the private television that is not so evidently favoring the government. But there is the problem of the control. If Berlusconi asks them to favor the government, they do that, I think.
Not only that, but Berlusconi recently appointed two strong supporters of his party to head up the traditionally left-wing state-run television. Media analysts now fear that criticism of his government from any Italian TV news shows will be silenced. Giuliano Ferrara, the editor of Il Foglio, a conservative opinion-shaping daily owned by Berlusconi's wife, says that Berlusconi is the only option for a nation bogged down in a long history of polarized politics and big bureaucracy.
You have to answer the question, is he fit or unfit for office? I think he is fit for office in this not normal situation, which is the Italian.
When the previous center-left government had a chance to clear up the conflict of interest, they didn't do it either. They'd hoped to make political hay out of it during the elections and sorely overestimated how much Italians cared about it. What the left also underestimated was the power of Berlusconi to divert the people from the problems of governing by appealing to their dreams. For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
As we've read this week, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill has caused something of a dust-up for criticizing President Bush's decision to impose tariffs on steel from abroad. Perhaps he should have known better than to express his disapproval during a dinner speech at the Council on Foreign Relations in front of some 300 members, including New York Times staffers. Or perhaps not. The council maintains strict guidelines that all statements at their meetings are strictly not for attribution. But O'Neill's remarks still wound up on the front page of the New York Times. So how did it get the story? Joining us to weigh in on all of this is Les Gelb, a former Times editor, now president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome back.
Always fun.
Okay, now let's run through these terms, off the record, not for attribution, etc., as they apply at a Council on Foreign Relations event.
The difference is very important. Not for attribution means you can say the substance of what was said to anyone, but you can't say who said it. When it's off the record, you can't identify either the speaker or the substance of what's said.
Now, each member of the council is aware of these guidelines, but
Right. Do
you always go over the rules and announce them at the beginning of each meeting?
We certainly did, and obviously the board of directors here and I and the staff are very upset when this happens because it goes to the whole issue of candor at our meetings. We have lots of journalists, as you know, members, almost 300 journalists. And it's very important for them and for the rest of us to get the kind of understanding of problems and issues and policies that you can't get in sort of set piece on the record speeches.
Right, but the New York Times piece said that it obtained its information independent of Times staffers on the council.
Right. I called Howell Raines, who is the executive editor of the Times, and expressed my concern that the information might have come from a Times reporter at the meeting who didn't observe the not-for-attribution rule. And Hal spoke to all the reporters who were in any way involved and assured me that none of them had broken the rule, that the information had come from a council member. And I told Hal, and I mean it, I accept his word 100%.
But you don't know who that member might be. It might have been
somebody
listening on the...
No, nor am I going to conduct an investigation. We're not the FBI. I'm issuing a statement in our monthly calendar reminding people of the importance of keeping our word. This has only happened 3 times in the history of this organization, and it shouldn't happen at all.
You said that your dinner speeches are frequently not for attribution. Are they ever off the record?
Yes. A few are, and it usually is when we have a smaller group after the general meeting, and we really want the conversation to be relaxed, where you're not watching your words at all. And in those instances, we often do put it off the record.
Do you ever wonder whether the public is being served by these meetings or whether it just contributes to the creation of a, you know, Washington-New York cabal that exists on a plane separate from the rest of us?
Look. It's not as if every American is equally interested in all this stuff. In fact, most Americans aren't very interested in these issues. And the issues are dealt with by particular groups that are intensely interested in a particular issue. So what we're doing, in a way, is broadening the number of people who get let in on the joke, so to speak. So I don't think we're undermining democracy. I think we're advancing it.
Well, Les, let me ask you, what exactly is the Council on Foreign Relations for people who don't know? I mean, there are people out there who probably lump it together with the Trilateral Commission.
Right. Well, I was even a member of the Trilateral Commission, but fortunately, since I never attended a meeting, they suggested I might drop out.
You shouldn't have said that.
Council is an organization of about 3,800 people from all around the country. And they're leaders and thinkers, and, you know, the membership runs from Newt Gingrich to Dan Ellsberg. And it includes everybody who's been Secretary of State for, I don't know how many years, 50 years almost. Almost every defense secretary, every NSC advisor. And it is critical that there be one place in our country where people who have differing views can come and discuss matters with one another without fear that it's going to become a public issue.
Or a headline in the New York Times.
Sure.
Les Gelb, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Les Gelb is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Coming up, trends and the reporters who love them, plus bad manuals and coach cliches.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with this week's OTM Trend. In Tennessee, a home gardener named Rita is using a syringe to inject her zucchini with an organic pesticide. Bob, an Illinois aquarium culturalist, feeds his water fleas by syringe-injecting pureed zucchini into a 55-gallon drum. And a mom named Christy tells her friends on BabyCradle.com that she uses the same technique to feed strained zucchini to her spoon-averse baby son. Yes, in one of the hottest trends of the new millennium, everywhere you turn nowadays, zucchini and medical syringes are turning up together. You know, or not. I actually found those examples by doing an internet search for the random combination of zucchini and syringe. The results were almost exclusively about organic gardening, but with a little selective editing by the generally accepted practices of journalism, the zucchini syringe marriage constitutes a bona fide trend.
It sounds like a cliche to say three things makes a trend, but that really is kind of the rule of thumb we look for.
Kim Willis is a features editor at USA Today, which has divined trends in premarital cohabitation, sport fishing, raw food diets, teen oral sex, men wearing engagement rings, and thousands of other phenomena real and hyped, for which the rule of three is the guiding principle, if not the actual definition.
We don't think, great, we found three examples, we can write a story. It's more, if we can't find three examples, is this really a trend?
Well, good for them. But of course, in a universe in which trillions of events occur in each fraction of a second, three favorable examples, or four or 4,000, don't necessarily mean anything. Yet journalists persist in extrapolating dubious trends from isolated anecdotes, demonstrating not a trend, but an immutable constant, the media's ongoing love affair with the fallacy of favorable enumeration. In fact, never mind the rule of three, journalism is the only place in the physical universe where one point can determine a line. Jessica Lustig is editor of Details magazine.
What we are trying to do is be entertaining and be timely and respond to things that we're sort of picking up in the culture. And you're right, there's something a bit made up about them. And what that is taking some scrap of data or information from the news or from cultural mood and then carrying it farther.
So, for instance, when somebody at Details noticed a gigantic Calvin Klein billboard prominently featuring in sharp, skimpy underwear relief a man's bulging genitalia,
we ran a piece wondering if this was going to provoke a kind of anxiety in men, a sort of self-consciousness that's been more associated with women till now and has resulted in all sorts of industries like, say, the Wonder Bra to respond to that anxiety.
So what happens when a magazine like Details, ostensibly the periodical of record for all that is hip and happening, decides that the world is ready for Wonder Pants? Well, one thing that happens is that the alleged trend may soon be embraced uncritically by other news organizations, who do their trend spotting not in the wild, but in the pages of other publications, creating a lost in the funhouse parallel universe of media-validated unreality. USA Today's Kim Willis worries about that all the time.
Because if In Style has written about it, and the Wall Street Journal has written about it, and then USA Today has written about it, then it's this huge trend and everyone in America is doing it. But often, you know, what's happening is one paper or magazine is seeing the other one's story and then saying, well, gee, maybe we should check this out.
Oddly, media hype isn't especially influential in the proliferation of genuine trends, according to author Malcolm Gladwell.
I think mass media can induce very transitory, ephemeral changes. But if you want to generate real fundamental transformation of behavior, speech, thought, anything like that, I think you need to have the kind of face-to-face, person-to-person, true viral transmission.
Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, investigates that moment of critical mass when an extremely localized fashion or fad begins behaving like a communicable disease infecting the general population. This, he says, happens independently of the media. What genuine trends and bogus trends do have in common, though, is their provenance in a tiny percentage of the population.
You read those stories, and when they proclaim a broad trend, you understand that what they're saying is that this is the kind of thing that those of us who would like to emulate the lifestyles of the approximately 1,000 people who we're describing in the story, you know, this is what they're doing, and do with that information as you will.
The hip-obsessed, in other words, writing about the truly hip for the wannabes of hipness. Journalist Michelle Goldberg has played the game herself.
As a freelance writer, I understand why writers create these stories, especially people who aren't staff writers, because it's so easy to sell. And so if you need to make a paycheck, you need to just, it's kind of like playing that game Concentration or something. You need to find three matching things and put them together, and you kind of create the narrative around that.
But Goldberg also sees the dangers. Apart from the obvious risk of misrepresenting reality, I mean, are men really rushing to wear engagement rings? There's the more pernicious danger of ignoring significant trends by obsessing on superficial, trivial ones. This was brought home to her while surveying major newspapers for their economic coverage in the wake of 9/11.
I was absolutely stunned. One of the first cover stories about this economic mess in the New York Times Magazine is about the future of Gucci. Meanwhile, you have to dig to see that homelessness is skyrocketing in this country. You see proportionally much, much, much less feature coverage of how people are dealing with, say, losing a job of 30 years and finding themselves on food stamps. than you do with the shattered dreams of a 24-year-old who can no longer get a $50,000 a year job for making flash animations.
Maybe that's because trend spotters are perpetually in search of something hot. And there is nothing hot about lost service industry jobs. Unfortunately, there is a fundamental disconnect between serious exploration of societal problems and the glib pursuit of hotness. The pitiful fact is, it's hard for many publications to consider the unemployed, for instance, unless they're kneeling in their backyards, tending to their tiny home gardens, shooting up their zucchinis.
Now, as part of our ongoing salute to execrable writing, we bring you the award winners of the second annual Worst Manual Contest. Technical Standards, Inc. is the San Diego-based company that confers that honor. Jim Desmond is the CEO. So, Jim, what are the principal characteristics of a truly terrible manual?
Well, most of our entries had them all. A lot of them are mixed up graphics that don't match. Just poor grammar, misspelled words.
The winner of your contest this year was an employee training manual, and in this case, the manual offers rules of conduct at the very beginning. And it begins by saying any infraction of the following rules can get you fired. There are 32 of them. This seems to be a manual which just made you want to quit your first day on the job.
Well, and if you look at it, it says it suggested that you read and follow these rules. Well, rule 3 is failure or refusing to do assigned work. Well, follow these rules. Poor workmanship. Stealing. It's just a list of all the things that would probably get you fired.
Many of the award recipients we saw were clearly victims of a bad translator. For instance, reading from the manual for the sliding bicycle, which we Americans might call the razor scooter, here's a quote. Make sure all the levers have been shut off again and again before using it. Operated on the loosened conditions of the levers without confirmation can cause the handle pole bent and cause incident. Be careful not to let your fingers got squeezed when installation and discharge.
It is a lot of loss in translation from some of the countries that are just hiring someone with a very limited English or knowledge in English as far as writing this. One was for a piece of exercise equipment. This was last year's winning entry. If you feel vomitive, dizzy or uncomfortable condition during exercise, stop exercising immediately. Another one of our entries from this year that wasn't a concerning translation was the we got one for a Rubik's Cube, I guess, to solve the cube. And it's the cube most of are familiar with is about 6 different colors, mm-hmm. and the directions are in black and white.
Well, that reminds me of another honorable mention on how to change a knife blade. But the illustration, if you look at it, shows a line drawing of a wrist, and it fails to show the key part of the process. You don't see the knife or the blade.
Yeah, I mean, even if someone's, you know, writing these things, you would think at least someone else would proof them or look them over at least once. I mean, that would be caught right away that you can't even see the product itself that they're trying to explain.
Are there any cliches in the manual world? I mean, phrases that tend to recur over and over again?
Well, attention symbols or warnings or flags that come up on some of the manuals. One of our entries this year was for a gas fire log, installing this gas fire log into your fireplace. And the first 2 pages are nothing but warnings, safety instructions, do not do this, important information for your safety. And the pages are screaming at you, almost as if, my gosh, I don't want to touch this thing because it's so scary. But a lot of that, you know, with the our litigious society today has to be included, but that's a case where it could be overdone. You know, don't use this ladder while you're in the bathtub or, you know, silly things like that. You'll come across. Someone told me about a hairdryer once. It was do not operate while sleeping, I think was the warning on there.
So is rinse, lather, repeat the call me Ishmael of your world?
That would be a great cliche. That'd be a great one for the technical. Yeah, rinse, lather, and repeat. Yes, that's a pretty good one.
Jim Desmond is CEO of Technical Standards, Inc.
In other cliche news, we're halfway down the road to the final 4 on the edge of our seats to see the next shoe drop, and you know what that means.
Any team that can come in and doesn't make a lot of mistakes, shoots the ball well, doesn't turn it over, rebounds well, and that's, I'm describing Southern Illinois, certainly is not going to beat themselves. You've got to beat them.
Yes, it means coach speak. pre- and post-game boilerplate, which, according to a shocking academic study by Wake Forest University professor John Llewellyn, turns NCAA coaches and other sports figures into purveyors of triteness.
Yes, but they give 110% effort.
Yeah, gotcha. But let me ask you my last question first. Academic research into sports cliches. How exactly does this serve mankind?
Well, the fact of the matter is, although the public perception of rhetoric is that it's a shorthand word for saying I disagree with you, that in reality we all have persuasive language approaches. And whether that's a sportscaster or a radio commentator or a politician, when you look at the way they use language, you understand their world better than before.
Could you give me a top 10 cliché list?
You will hear, you know, how well the other team played, how everybody left it on the court, how the losers are heartbroken, with or without tears, depending upon personality traits and sort of how far along the ultimate path you are. The winning coaches' acts of humility are always interesting to me because, it's of course, these are people who are fiercely competitive, and yet at the moment when they've had their greatest success, they understand the wisdom of treating their success in sort of lower case. You know, I didn't score a basket. You know, we coached these kids and the kids did all the work. But the other thing to consider about that is that, you know, even cliches may be true.
Is this the result of generations of athletes being burned by giving honest, spontaneous responses?
I think the possibility of getting burned is a part of this. But I also think there's sort of an etiquette of competition that leads to fierce on-court efforts and very genteel off-court responses. There's an old Bear Bryant line, at least I've heard it attributed to him, that, you know, if you want to have a whole lot of trouble on Saturday, just run your mouth on Friday. In any competition, it's impolitic to do anything to fire up your opponent.
Why don't coaches and athletes themselves simply process the question and, instead of searching for some appropriate response, actually say what they're thinking? Or have they actually come to believe the canned response they're about to mouth anyway?
I think that your latter answer is more likely. The world of this kind of approach to sport has become self-creating and self-defining. Because if you listen carefully now, even high school athletes make the same sorts of attributions and talk in the same way as college athletes and college coaches. It's really sort of an oral tribal culture where people have learned from their elders how to understand the cosmos.
Well, I just want to say this has been one of the greatest experiences of my life. And first, I want to thank God for the opportunity to talk with you. And thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
John Llewellyn is an associate professor of communication at Wake Forest University. Now, John, I want you to get out there and profess, and I want you to get out there and communicate. Let's go.
When athletes and coaches resort to meaningless boilerplate, we tend to be dismissive. But we are also aghast when the same people speak their minds freely and invective spews forth. John Rocker scandalized baseball when he complained about New York and minority New Yorkers in Sports Illustrated. Last year in the same magazine, San Francisco giant Jeff Kent, bad-mouthed, notoriously aloof teammate Barry Bonds, then had to frantically backtrack. And this week, Milwaukee Bucks coach George Karl got into trouble, complaining to Esquire magazine about reverse discrimination in the NBA coaching ranks. Karl apologized and said he made a mistake, but the specific mistake he acknowledged was not race-baiting, but speaking candidly to a reporter. So this got Bob to musing about the truth, insufficient truth, and reporter-interview relationships.
Yeah, George Karl, a professional coach with 30 years' experience dealing with the media, should have known better than to let his guard down. But after 3 days with Esquire writer Scott Rabb, Karl explained, "You start to think he's your friend." Now, I don't know how Scott Rabb goes about his business, and maybe he was nothing but straightforward in his dealings with Karl. But this episode is merely the latest to raise the question, how does a media-savvy story subject come to be lulled into the illusion that the reporter is somehow on his side? By word and deed, by tone of voice and body language, by artful introduction and strategic withholding of complete candor, reporters, producers, and TV bookers routinely do a whole lot of lulling. Even when we make no explicit claim, we certainly allow interview subjects to imagine that the interview somehow serves them. which occasionally it does for reasons of business, politics, vanity, or whatever. But fundamentally, the interview is meant to serve only the reporter and the story. That is immutable. And when that fundamental reality is obscured, something unsettling is going on. That's what New Yorker writer Janet Malcolm had in mind when she famously observed, "All journalism is a lie." She was writing specifically about Joe McGinnis and his fulsome cultivation of murder convict Jeffrey McDonald, whom McGinnis would go on to portray as a monster in the best-selling book Fatal Vision. But the principle, to greater or lesser degrees, applies across the board. Journalistic representations of sympathy, or even the tonal implication of sympathy, is disingenuous at best. I'm not proposing a mandatory declaration of self-interest, a journalistic Miranda warning or some such, and I'm certainly not suggesting that incautious statements don't often yield important journalistic results. To pick one among countless examples, nobody wishes that gubernatorial candidate David Duke had been shrewd enough to avoid showing his fascist stripes. But I am suggesting that shocking candor seldom occurs in a vacuum, that it is too easy, in the name of establishing a rapport with the story subject, to cross the line into false sympathy. And I'm further suggesting that it is time for all journalists to look deep into our hearts to face the question, in our search for truth, do we ourselves obscure it at the very first stage of the process? That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan and Lou Olkowski. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.